Good morning, church.
Good morning.
Really thought I was going to hear Tommy say, start, when the night has come, that we need to put Stand By Me up there. And I was like, all right, I like this one. A little different version than Elvis sang, evidently. It's good to be here, and it's such a beautiful day. It's nice to have a day with a little sunshine and blue skies out there, and it's a great day for our graduates. I'm excited for them, for what the future holds for them, and what God's plans for them. They don't know, we don't know, only God knows. But we get to work that out through Him, so I'm excited for them and all that. If you're a fan of the NFL, and then you know that this time of year is kind of the anticipatory time. You know, the Super Bowl is long past, the draft is now past, and all these teams are kind of building up. And I read an article the other day that was about the most miserable fan bases for professional football. We're not going to get to all the others, but they went through and they ranked the most miserable fan bases, not just based on their team record over the years, but on heartbreaking losses and bad ownership and just everything that goes into making for a bad fan experience, for trying to root for a bad losing franchise. And if you're curious, the Titans were 11th on the list. Now, at the very top of the list were some of the perennially bad teams throughout the history of the NFL. The ones you might expect, like the Jets and the Browns and the Lions and the Dolphins. And if you follow the sport now, you know that not all those teams are bad now. Some of them are actually pretty good. And so even though they're good now, what these fans come to expect is that they're just finding new and creative ways to break their heart. Because that's the way it's always gone. You know, the Dolphins may have Dan Marino, the best quarterback in the league, but somehow they're going to be disappointed in the end. And the Jets may have, you know, a good quarterback now. In fact, last year the Jets put together a really highly regarded coaching staff, quality coaching staff. They dramatically improved their players, brought in all these new players, drafted really well, and they capped it off by bringing in one of the best quarterbacks in the league, Aaron Rodgers, only to see Rodgers get injured on his fourth play ever for the Jets. I mean, just all fell apart before it even started. So Jet fans were really, and they were just miserable. And yet year after year, game after game, play after play, these dejected fans find themselves holding out a sliver of hope that somehow, some way, this will be their year, their opportunity, their chance at redemption. Volunteer fans, you know what I'm talking about. Razorback fans, Kentucky fans, y'all know what it's like. Alabama fans, I don't want to hear a word about them. So what is it that keeps bringing us back? And is there such thing as a breaking point? Like the point at which we just give up hope and throw in the towel, we're completely done. What would it take to push you over the edge and make you completely give up? Well, as we continue our study through the minor prophets, last week we got an overview of the book of Hosea. And as we're going to see, Israel has pushed God to that point. The point at which, God is just ready to throw in the towel. And unlike the, and I'm going to use finger quotes here, unlike the relationship between a team and its fans, the relationship between God and His people is real, it is personable, it is intimate, like a husband and wife. Not like a fan of a singer or a politician or a sports team. This is a real personal relationship. And so when that disappointment comes, when that time comes, what will happen? So in Hosea chapter 1, verse 2, the prophet Hosea begins his message with this word from the Lord. It says, the Lord said to him, go marry a promiscuous woman. And we're going to keep the words large and general here. And have children with her. For like an adulterous wife, this land is guilty of faithlessness to the Lord. I mean, can you imagine? If you met someone who said, well, this is who God told me to marry, you're like, I don't think God told you to marry that person, right? Of all the difficult things for us to wrap our minds around, it is the why would God command one of his followers, a prophet, to do such a thing? It sounds absolutely scandalous, and no doubt it was worse at the time. A prophet of God marrying, we're just going to use the word prostitute. It was disgraceful. But God knows his people. God knows us. He knows you and he knows me and he knows our limitations. And he knows that we often need to see things firsthand that we can understand to move us towards understanding those things we can't understand. In other words, we needed to see it in action. They needed to see it in action. In this instance, the Israelites needed to see and understand what their idolatry and immorality actually was doing. How they were being unfaithful to their covenant of God, and that made what they were doing like adultery. How their unfaithfulness or faithlessness was like adultery. So this is where it begins, with this marriage between Hosea and Gomer, so that they can see how they were behaving. But then it gets worse. Much more involved, but a lot messier, uglier, far worse for the people of God in Israel. Because out of this marriage between Hosea and Gomer come three children. Now, the first child is Hosea's child. It says Gomer bore Hosea a child. The first child is Hosea's. And God tells him, I want you to name this first child Jezreel. And understand this name that got every one of these children means something. To understand Jezreel, we have to have a real quick history lesson. You can go back and read about it in 2 Kings chapters 9 and 10. Basically, the king of Israel at that time in their history was a guy named Ahab. And maybe you've heard of King Ahab, and maybe you remember his wife, more famously Jezebel. So Ahab and Jezebel were on the throne, and God was like, this is enough of this. And so he sends his prophet Elisha. And Elisha gets a message, and he goes to do it, and he runs into this military camp, and he says, you know, I need to see Jehu. And Jehu's like, that's me. And he says, all right, Jehu. And this is such a strange thing, because God says, you go do this, and you run out of there. No questions, no discussion. You just run in there, you do it, and you run out, which had to have been a crazy scene. This prophet running into a military camp and says, Jehu, yes, hey, you're king, and I want you to go kill some people. See ya. And then he turns around and he runs away. And Jehu's like, did y'all see that? I mean, it was a bizarre scene even at that time. But Jehu takes him seriously because he is told to kill King Ahab and all of his family. And so Jehu is the new king of Israel. Nobody knows it yet, Jehu and those guys in the tent with him. But he is a warrior king appointed by the prophet Elisha. And so he goes out and he does what he's told to do. He goes and he does not just kill Ahab and Jezebel, which he does. He kills everybody. Everybody who is related to them, even vaguely. Gets them all together in a place. He's like, I know y'all are all innocent. And they're like, yes, thank goodness you don't think we're King Ahab and Jezebel. He goes, I'm going to kill you anyway. And he does. I mean, it is a massacre. Efficiently and brutally killed every one of Ahab's family. The name of the place where he did this was Jezreel. Jezreel was a brutal and bloody beginning to Jehu's dynasty. And Jehu has a son who has a son. And in essence, by instructing Hosea to name his first son Jezreel, God is reminding the Israelites that their kingship, their reign began with a bloody massacre. and that God is going to end their reign the exact same way. Israel, your king started with violence and brutality. It's going to end the same way. That's the first child. Second child, and this one is unclear whether it's, we know Gomer had the child, so it's for sure Gomer's. We don't know if it's Hosea's or if it's one of her other guys that she was spending time with. So God tells Hosea to name this second child Lo-Ruhama. Lo-Ruhama. The word Lo in Hebrew, not. That's it. Lo means no or not. And so Lo-Ruhama means unloved, not loved, or no compassion. In effect, this child of Israel is not going to be loved by God. God is telling Israel, I'm going to remove my special care and protection of you. I'm not going to pity or care about you anymore. What happens to you, happens to you. And this would have been a dramatic shift for the Israelites, who, that's their whole identity. That's who we are. We are the people who are loved and protected and honored and cherished by Yahweh God. And God says, not anymore. You know, God is supposed to have this unfailing love, and somehow it is now gone. In actuality, of course, it was not God who broke the covenant. It was the Israelites who broke the covenant. And God is just honoring their breaking of the covenant. But then it gets worse. Because the last child born to Gomer is absolutely not Hosea's. And we know this because the name God told Hosea to give the child. The last child, Lo-Ami. Lo, remember, again, not. Ami, mine. Not mine. You could probably think of some words in English that would signify that's not my child. That was born to my wife, but that is not my child. Or vice versa, to the husband, not my child. It is a full severing of all ties that Israel has to God. This is the end of God and Israel's relationship. No longer mine. What you have done, the acts you have committed, you are no longer my children. Your identity has changed because you have committed, not just had adultery, but you have committed yourself to someone else, something else. Now, when you step back and you look at the names of these kids and the meanings of their names, you can see that it's actually kind of a progression. Like it gets progressively worse. Not just the punishments, but what was happening in the relationship there. That step by step, Israel has chosen to walk down a path further and further away from God. And that's, in reality, that's a picture of the way sin works in all of our lives. Not just Israel, but in all of our lives. Because step by step, bit by bit, sin takes a larger and larger bite out of our commitment to God. And with that comes more and more severe consequences, right? Consequences that can ultimately lead to a broken relationship with God. And rightfully so, because it's not God breaking the relationship. It is God giving us the free will to do what we've chosen. We have chosen someone or something besides Him. God says, I don't want you to do that, but you're free to do that. That's what Israel did, and that's what we can do. And if the story of Hosea and Gomer, the story of God and Israel, ended right here, everyone would say, well, I understand. I mean, if Hosea was your friend, and he was telling you about what his wife Gomer had done, you were like, look, she's chosen someone else. I don't know what to tell you. You just got to let her go. And if someone were to describe the actions of Israel towards God, yeah, God, Israel, they've chosen another God. You just got to let her go, right? So everyone would understand it if this was the end, because they have done absolutely nothing to deserve a continued relationship. But it does not end here. Not because Gomer got herself together and she woke up one morning and said, what am I doing with this other guy who's not my husband? Not because Israel woke up one morning and said, what am I doing with this other God? I should go back to God and repented. Not at all. Not because of who they are, but because of who God is. So as you're reading Hosea 1, you get this really dramatic shift at the very end. You get this whole story of Israel and Gomer's relationship and how that of Hosea and Gomer's relationship, how that illustrated God and Israel. And then immediately after the third child is born, we read this. Yet the Israelites will be like the sand on the seashore, which cannot be measured or counted. In the place where it was said to them, you are not my people, they will be called children of the living God. The people of Judah, who are, remember, that's the southern tribe, and the people of Israel, the northern tribe, will come together, which has not been happening for generations now. They're going to come together, and they're going to appoint one leader, not a king over Israel and a king over Judah. They're going to have one leader who is going to come up out of the land. For great will be the day of Jezreel. Remember that place? Say of your brothers, my people, and of your sisters, my loved one. Do you remember the names of those children? Jezreel, not loved, and not my people. God essentially takes those names of those children, the consequences of Israel's unfaithfulness, and he takes them and twists them here at the very end. Jezreel becomes not a place of punishment, becomes a place of celebration, a place worth celebrating. The unloved becomes the loved. The faithless becomes faithful. The covenant is fully restored from not belonging to God to belonging to God. Every one of those exact Hebrew names is repeated here at the end in a positive way. Now, to understand the implications of this passage, I'm going to give you just a very simple, basic explanation of the covenant. The covenant between God and the people of Israel and Judah, right, all the descendants of Abraham, looks something like this. It is a covenant between God and the people and the land. When the people are faithful to God, they're in the land, God is in the land. When God is in the land, the people get to be in the land. It's just a three-way relationship. So when the people are being punished, most famously, they go into exile, right? Because they're taken out of the land, which means they've severed their relationship with God. It is God, people, and land, all three together. And here at the end, God is restoring every one of this. The people are going to be restored to themselves. The people of Israel are going to be reunited with the people of Judah. And we're not going to be fighting back and forth and having border wars back and forth. Now, we're going to be brother and sister, fully kin again. And our relationship with God that once was severed, we were broken off from God. God says, yes, you're going to be my people. And it's going to happen in that place, in that land that I gave you. Everything about the covenant is going to be restored. And all of that culminates, you skip ahead to chapter 3, in this ultimate act of grace. The Lord said to me, Hosea, go show your love to your wife again. Though she is loved by another man, and she is an adulteress, love her as the Lord loves the Israelites, though they turn to other gods and love the sacred raisin cakes, which is basically an idolatrous offering, right? What God is saying is that I'm going to be loyal to you even when you're not loyal to me. I'm going to love you even when you don't love me. When you make the most disastrous and worst decisions of your life, When you run as far away from God as you possibly can, when you make not just one wrong decision, but wrong decision after wrong decision after wrong decision after wrong decision, and you're completely out of the life of God, and the life of God is completely out of you, when you have done everything possible to remove yourself from the presence of God, when you have broken and rebroken and rebroken to the point there's no hope, when you are at that point, there stands God, just like he always was. What the book of Hosea makes clear is that the love of God is unfailing. Now, that's not to say it's not without consequences. I mean, God is a God who is a God of consequences, and he lets us reap what we sow. But not so far as he is concerned, because God is always faithful. Not just to the people who are his, God is faithful to the people who are not his. That's what he's telling Israel. That I am faithful to you when you are not my people. So if you are not a Christian this morning, you have not made a commitment to God whatsoever in your life, you don't live by God's standards, you don't live under God's law, you don't call yourself a Christian, you don't claim that title, you don't live that way, even though you are apart from God, God is still faithful to you. And if you are a one-time Christian, who has run as far as you can the other way, and you think you couldn't get any further, God is still faithful to you. And if you are a Christian who has taken a step or two or three or five or 20 in the wrong direction, but you're still holding out hope, God is still faithful to you. God is going to be faithful regardless. The only question is, how will we respond to God's love? God is going to be demonstrating his love regardless of what we do. The question is, how will we respond to it? When we are down on the ground and down on our luck and down on ourselves and down on our lives, and God stands there with extended hand, how will we respond to God's love? God will never take us down or grab us off the ground and forcibly shake us up and say, you've got to do this. But he's always going to be standing there, extending the possibility for new life, for new hope, for new relationship, for a restored covenant with him, that he may be your God and you may be his people. And this morning, if we can pray for you, encourage you, lift you up in any way, we want to do that now. Won't you come as we stand and as we sing?